This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello, and thanks very much for downloading this podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, coming to you today from my living room in rural Aberdeenshire, because outside is absolutely filthy today. Sort of gale force winds and just those sheets of rain that keep on coming across all the time and have been for about the last 12 hours. It's rotten. A few miles to the south, Helen Needham.
I've got my blanket over my knees, my sheepskin slippers on. It's just the kind of day where you think, I'll just sit by the fire and dream of summer, of nicer days, of all these things.
Well, this is a good day to dream because our guest today is a self-professed dreamer. She's an award-winning illustrator and writer who produces the most beautiful depictions of the natural world for children and adults alike. She worked with Robert McFarlane on The Lost Words, Spell Songs, and now The Lost Spells. Jackie Morris, we're absolutely delighted to welcome you to the podcast.
Well, thank you very much. And I would just like to really brag about my blue sky, which I have outside. I woke up this morning thinking, what is this strange colour? Because it's been raining so much, I have an interesting water feature in my garden now. But it's just gorgeous here.
Ah, well, you are well ahead of us. Give me an explanation or a description of where you are. Where do you stay?
I live in a very small cottage, which is held together by spiders' webs, and it's on the Welsh coast, so it's the bottom corner of Wales where it sticks out into the sea. It's a peninsula, so I've got craggy rocks up to the north of me with seal-breeding beaches. And then out to the east is White Sands Bay, which is really beautiful, where the sun sets. And over to the south would be St David's, which is Britain's smallest city. And boy, is it quiet here when all the holiday homeowners aren't allowed to be here.
We have, rather optimistically, I think, asked you to choose seven creatures for us to discuss today. I'm not a betting man, but I'd be willing to bet the house that we end up talking about more than seven. Let's not worry about details. One of the ones I know you've picked is the ash tree. Why? What is it you love about ash?
Well, I love trees anyway. I think with animals, I've always seen animals, birds especially, they've always caught my eye. And trees, I've had less of a connection with them, but love their shape. The one thing that we don't have much of here is trees because of the way the wind blows. So I've got two small oak trees in the garden, which are doing quite well. But when I bought my house, the most exciting thing for me was that it has this beautiful ash tree in the garden, which has grown up with my children. The shape of her is rather lovely. She grows out of a wall. My kids used to spend the summer in hammocks like peas in a pod, reading books in her branches. The thing that is really grieving me at the moment is that I think she's got ash dieback, and I'm not sure there's any way back from that. There are a lot of little saplings around, but there's a lot of branches falling, and the leaves were not as rich this summer. But yeah, I love trees. I love the shape of them. I love what they give us, the shade, even the logs. You know, I've got a wood-burning stove. It's my only form of heating.
Just out of curiosity, why is the tree a she?
I'm not sure. Just feels that way. I don't know with the sex of trees. There are some male and female trees, aren't there? Holly bushes have a male and female. I'm not sure whether ash do, but just in my mind, there's a female pronoun there.
You worked with the singer Kareem Polwart on Spell Songs, which is the musical offshoot of the Lost Words project. And when we interviewed Kareem on this podcast, we talked about the fact that you'd depicted all the musicians, and indeed Robert McFarlane himself, as animals on or birds. Kareen, the wren, Robert, a mountain hare. What are you?
What am I? Nothing knows what I am. As the raven says in The Lost Words, I shapeshift between different things. Raven is what I would love to be. I would so love to fly. And the way that they ride the wind, hang in the air, do that beautiful flipping when they're flying. But when I was young, I wanted most of all, apart from being an artist, to be a bear. And many, many people told me that I could not be an artist because art is not a job, it is just a hobby. But nobody told me that I couldn't be a bear. So it's been a great disappointment to me when I've grown up to find that I couldn't become one.
Did you have any particular kind of bear in mind?
Very grizzly, very, very... That young McFarlane, he does call me Grumpy Bear sometimes, but only when he's a long way away.
See, before we go any further, it might be worthwhile you explaining a bit about the Lost Words, Spell Songs, Lost Spells phenomenon, you know, that you've worked on with Robert McFarlane.
It didn't start out as a phenomenon, it started out as an idea that was born from a letter that I was asked to sign by a poet called Lawrence Rose. And the letter was a response to the Oxford Junior Dictionary, the illustrated version, who had removed some words from their dictionary in favour of other words. And the words that had gone were words like bluebell, adder, acorn, conker. And words that had gone in were words which I think of as being kind of transitory and shallow, celebrity being one of them. Chat room, things like that. Anyway, the feeling from some of us who work with language was that these words were more important. And for me, my gut feeling was, how do you explain to a child who may grow up to be a developer, not necessarily an artist or a poet, that a bluebell wood is a thing of incredible value when the word isn't even in the dictionary, but also a wren, such a beautiful bird. If you don't know the name of it, if you don't hear it, you don't see it. And what a loss in your life that is.
I love the concept of the lost words because the Oxford Junior Dictionary had taken a pragmatic decision. We've got a certain amount of space. These words are no longer current. You, however, and your team took a, you know, a sort of creative decision in saying, we are going to give these words added stickability. We're going to get them into kids' brains in a way that they stick. And you have.
Yeah, and we had no idea it would go as well as it did. The thing that I have loved the most about it is children writing their own work inspired by the book, doing their own paintings, and we're constantly getting sent pictures of them, you know, whole school projects, escaping from the classroom into the outdoors to go and find the things, and looking at dandelions for the first time. Just amazing. I love children's artwork. I love that they're finding their voices through the natural world and speaking up for these things.
The Lost Words then turned into the Spell Songs project, and you worked with various folk musicians to form the musical version of it. And we're going to be weaving some of your musical choices through our conversation today. The folk idiom seems to lend itself really well to the kind of subject matter you're interested in, lots of myth and storytelling. Do you listen to music as you paint?
I always used to listen to radio and music, and I do find myself drawn very much to folk music. I think partly I love the story in folk music. There are so many stories wrapped up in them. And also it is close to the earth, and it's close to working people as well. I loved working with the musicians so much, and a lot of the Lost Words was made listening to Kareen, listening to Julie, listening to Seiku. So to actually find myself working with them, both Rob and myself, when we first met up in the Lake District, we were just sitting there pinching each other and going, look, 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 this Julie Fowler, she's sitting over there. And I was going, yeah, she's reading your book. Oh, it's my book as well. Yeah. For me as well, I stayed for the whole of the first residency and I watched how they built music out of silence, how they pulled it out of the pigment and the pages. It was peak Brexit time. So on the other hand, in Parliament, you had these people ripping each other to pieces and parading their egos. And in Mornington, we had people combining their talents to step up and speak and step back and let somebody else speak and create something beautiful. I'd always looked at learning music to be learning an instrument, but I could see more value in it to teach cooperation. To teach people how to work together to make beauty. So I have a much stronger passion now for keeping music in school, for making instruments available, because of the further reach that that has for learning.
So we learn what words your long leaves loosen. Whisper when the wind blows. Listen for a day, a week, till we know what the willows say. Lean in, oh, let's snores. Listen for a week, a day, but you will never hear what willows say.
Let's take a look at another one of the species, the hare. You've written about them in your book, the Song of the Golden Hare. I mean, how did you come to that story? Are there many hares in Pembrokeshire?
There's not many hares in Pembrokeshire, no. I grew up in Evesham and then moved to Broadway, to the Cotswolds. I still remember seeing my first ever wild hare, which just rose up out of the ground and ran and leapt over this stone wall that was the same colour as the hare's fur. It was as if there was nothing else in the world, just this movement, just this spark, just this creature. So the story came, I think, from a desire to paint more hares. And then I tend to take myself outside and walk when I need to find a story. And it threaded itself into my brain. I sit on top of the hill above my house when I write. And that's where it came from. But to see hares, I went with a lady called Viv, who lived on a farm near Stonehenge, and I sat in her extremely cold Land Rover that smelt of dogs.
They all do.
Six in the morning. The ground was solid, iron hard. There was a low mist and barn owl just coasted through this. And then as the light came into the day, the hares kind of rose up from the ground, and because we'd been there for a while, wrapped up in these blankets, they were so close, and you could see the hares' breath, just watching them pulling the warm back into themselves. Just wonderful, yeah. I mean, you can work from photographs, but it's always better to actually see the living thing in order to make it real.
In sort of mythology, the hare, the brown hare, was a symbol of licentiousness. And I've never quite understood that. I don't see it as being a licentious animal.
It was a symbol of many things, wasn't it? It was a trickster. There's a lot of myth around it. And sailors won't go to sea if they see a hare. Don't really understand that. Hares can swim. I love the shape-shifting hare. The woman who turns into a hare, the hare who turns into the woman, they were often connected to witchcraft. And at one time, people thought they laid eggs, which I think is quite wonderful.
I shall go into a hare with sorrow, sigh, and a mickle cow.
ha, I shall go into a ha, with sorrow, sigh, and remickle care. I go to the devil in the devil's name, and stay till I come home again. I go to the devil in the devil's name, and stay till I come home again. I shall go into...
There's another hare mentioned in Lost Spells, the mountain hare, the white snow hare. Different sort of creature altogether.
The hare turns white as the year turns black. Oh, the rain is falling. The hare turns white as the year turns black. Oh, the dark is rising. By the loch of the birds, he hunkers down in the heather. He waits for the veil of snow to come and cover him over.
When we first got together with the Spell Songs team, Snowhare was an extra spell that had been written because we couldn't stop. We carried on working after the lost words. And Julian Corrine took the words from Snowhare, made a song.
By the cairn of the goose, he hunkers down in the heather. He longs for the veil of snow to come and cover him over.
And then what Rob's done is he's taken their words and worked them back into the spell. So it's very much collaboration, echoing. It's like call and response, I suppose.
Oh, the dark is rising. By the rock of the stack, he shelters in from the weather. He prays for the veil of snow to come and cover him over.
Snowhair whitens as the year turns dark by the cairn of the wolf in the glen of the lark. Night grows stronger, sleet falls sharp on crag and moor by the burn of the deer on the eagle's tor. Out on the hill, hare hunkers under hag, hides in heather by the lock of the buzzard at the pass of the weather. Wears the cold, vanishes into spindrift, hail, blizzard's flight. Hare walking is graceless, all long-limbed levers by the salmon river on the road of the reavers. Awkward pistons, steam-powered shunts and sudden shocks by the ford of the pines in the hollow of the fox. Hare running, though, flows through snow like water over stone by the cliff of the kite at the peak of the Rowan. Each long line of tracks, a row of inkwells in the white.
Let's talk about the fox now, because like the hare, you've depicted two types of this species. You wrote a book called The White Fox. How did that one come about?
I'm not a well-travelled person, but my publisher said to me they wanted me to go to Seattle. And to begin with, I said no. And then I realised that in Seattle, just up the road, was the Snow Leopard Trust. And I'd done another book called The Snow Leopard. And the Snow Leopard Trust had said, if ever you're passing, as people do, if you're passing Seattle, then pop in and we'll show you our snow leopards. And then the other thing was 20 minutes away lives Robin Hobb, who is an amazing author of fantasy fiction. And I've done a lot of jackets for her. And I thought, oh my word, I could go and see Robin, see the snow leopards. And so I said, yes. But it was amazing. We saw the snow leopards. And then the lady, Sarah, who was showing us around, she said, oh, I don't want you to go. I don't want you to go. Do you want to come and see the North American exhibit? And I went, yeah. Thinking, I'll just say yes to anything at this stage because you never know what might happen. Oh, and there were bears, brown bears, the first time I'd ever seen them. And they were just so beautiful. And there was also this little white fox curled up. And she told me this story about how this fox had got into a dumpster in Alaska and got kind of tipped out onto the docks in Seattle and then run away. And the dockers had caught it. They trapped it, I think, with a peanut butter sandwich, which is what everybody knows is what you use if you want to catch an animal, is a peanut butter sandwich. They'd phoned up the police, who'd said, oh, keep it there, we'll come and shoot it. And then the dockers kind of pretended that it ran away because they didn't want it to get shot. And they'd got in touch with the wildlife park and asked them if they would have it. And so that was the start of the story. And then I wrote something much more than that about it, and also changed the ending because I like things to be wild and free.
And this really brought out the theme of being uneasy in your own skin.
Yes, yes. I mean, I guess that's how most people feel. I know as a child I felt so uncomfortable being human, being female, being who I had been born into. And I guess most of my work that I've done has been about shape-shifting, transforming into animals. And my painting kind of allows me to do that because you have to imagine yourself inside that skin in order to paint it, I think. Well, that's how I do it anyway.
So you try to imagine what it would be like to be a fox.
Well, everything, every character in any book, you have to become all of them. It's like your own theatre, I suppose. For me, that's what books are. They're like a kind of paper theatre. So I have to be everything, even the dandelion.
Do you read the parts out loud to yourself?
I do. Yeah. This is one of the things I said to Rob when he first started working, you know, because it wasn't his natural territory was not children's writing. You know, I said to him, don't dumb down. I don't know why people, when they have been children themselves, are so patronising to children. Because...
Or old people.
Yeah, we've all been children, and if we're lucky, we'll all be old people. To remember what it's like to be a child, to have that that astonishing bright mind that is uncluttered by so many things... So one of the first things is if you're writing for children, you don't write down because they are capable of understanding extremely complex things. And also if they don't know the language, they'll find it out. And then the other thing is so many books that are written for young people are read aloud. So you need to hear it. You need to taste it. You need to know what it sounds like. It's different when you speak it to when it's written on the page.
The red fox in the Lost Spells, it starts, I am red fox, how do you see me? And then in the final verse, why do you need me? Which kind of shows that foxes are viewed in many different ways depending on your perspective.
I'm a big fan of the red fox, unsurprisingly. My neighbour is not so much because she just lost all her chickens to one. The red fox was written for the prom in the Albert Hall. There was a Lost Words prom. Did you know about that?
I did hear about it, yeah. How was it?
In retrospect, absolutely terrifying. standing on the stage, I didn't realise how big it was until I saw photos of it much later. But I had to memorise the red fox spell and paint a red fox while I spoke it.
You were painting on the stage at the Albert Hall?
On the stage at the Albert Hall with a choir and... an orchestra, wow. Yes.
So you're painting to time?
No. No, I was painting in desperation. When you speak the spell and paint at the same time, there is a rhythm in the movement, or possibly the two things balance and work together. So I do it with otters as well. So you kind of almost spell the pigment onto the page with the words. And it's a curious balance and it's quite hypnotic. It's also quite witchy. But it's nicer if you don't have like an audience of thousands and are on a stage. It's better to do it in the privacy of your own home when nobody's watching, really.
And that raises the point actually about these, because they are designed as spells for people to recite.
Yes, they are. Yes.
Do people get in touch with you and say when they've done it? Or is it taking off? Do people do that?
People do it. They, especially children have been learning the Jackdaw spell and learning it by heart, which is fantastic. Beautiful stories, like there was a lady who said, I'd never seen an otter before. There's a Lost Words exhibition that's touring. It's locked down in the Sill in Northumbria at the moment, but it was in Inverleith House in Edinburgh. Anyway, she went to the exhibition. She stood in front of the otters and she recited the spell three times. And 2 days later, she saw two otters underneath the bridge. She said, never seen an otter before, but they were kind of in the same configuration as the ones in the painting, bless them, kind of curling around each other. Somebody else told me that they'd done that with a kingfisher as well. It's really good. Summoning charms, yes. I'm forever summoning adders in the summer.
Does it work?
Sometimes it works. Does it work? It was a very curious thing when I was working on the Lost Words. It was almost as if something strange was happening. So when I was doing the magpies, outside my studio there's a blackthorn hedge, and the magpies started building the nest, like the one that's in the picture, building it up into... Oh, just amazing. When I was doing the wrens, everywhere I looked, there seemed to be little wrens, even in really unusual places, like down the beach, underneath my van, you know, places where I'd never seen a wren before. It has a name which is called frequency illusion. You know, if you're looking for something, you find it more than if you're not paying attention. But it also has a feeling which is like natural magic.
Can you read for us another animal from within the Lost Words? The heron.
Here hunts heron, here haunts heron, huge hinged heron, grey-winged weapon. Eked from iron and reeked from blue and beaked with steel, heron, statue, seeks eel. Rock still at Wearsill, stone still at Wearsill, dead still at Wearsill. Still at Wearsill, until, eelless at Wearsill, heron magically unstatues. Out of the water creaks long legs heron, old priest heron. From here on in, all sticks and planks and rubber bands, all clanks and clicks and rusty squeaks. Now heron hauls himself into flight, early aviator, heavy freighter, and with steady wing beats boosts his way through evening light to roost.
They are remarkably elegant birds. It's as if he'd sort of given a sculpture free rein and said, create me an interesting looking bird and I'm going to stand it by a river somewhere.
I love that soft grey of them and how they shapeshift so they can become snake-like, and then they have that real kind of grumpy, slouched, you know, standing in the rain, scrunched up heron. But beautiful colours and shape. Lovely to paint. Really lovely.
The curlew, which I think is a favourite for so many, simply because of the call. It's just so lyrical, not to mention the distinctive beaks. Have you got them around you there?
Yeah, we do. Got curlews and whimbrels. And I saw quite a large flock of them the other day. When the last storm that came in, they were just circling out from the beach and round. So, yeah, we got curlews and oyster catchers. And we have a lot of raptors here as well, which is fantastic. But the curlew, something about the shape of the curlew, it never occurred to me that they weren't born with a beak that long, that it grew. Isn't that ridiculous? You know, how's that going to fit in an egg, for goodness sake? So the longer the beak, the older the curlew. I'm working on another book with Rob at the moment, which is the Book of Birds. So, and curlew is one of those birds. So I get a second go at a curlew. And he, I know, has a great fondness for them as well, being a mountain man. I've only seen them down on the shores, really. I guess, yeah, some Welsh hills I've seen them.
We get them up in the fields here in the summertime. And, you know, the land rises to the south. And they will come off the fields and circle. And then they will kind of almost parallel the slope of the ground. You know, they almost slide down on invisible wires. And they just trail this bird song behind them in the evening. It's just beautiful.
It's such music, isn't it? I mean, more and more, I think, since lockdown, I've been listening just with the windows open to the wild music that is all around. When I was a kid, there were such big flocks of lapwings. There were such big flocks of curlews. And I know farmers always say that they're like the custodians of the land, but the fall of the curlew, it falls at their feet. With farming practices, really, ploughing up pasture and destroying nests so that the curlews don't breed through the season and their chicks get mashed up by combine harvesters. And I love lapwings. I love that they're really eerie, really witchy song. Inga Thompson has an amazing lapwing song where she talks about the lapwings being the souls of lost children.
We are the lost unfortunates, the wandering souls of wastrel children. We, the ghosts of men who throng the cross with hounds of Gabriel. We, who guard the gates as wings of witches curse the sky. Little can we do to lift this blanket man of lies.
The Linnaean name for lapwing, Vanellus vanellus, means little fan, and it's how it flies.
And those wings, they so scoop the air, don't they? That spoon end of the wing, the twists and the turns when you see them doing their aerial mating dances.
They lustily awaited on the lowland fence for our arrival, hoarded up our jewels and food, hindrance to our survival. We revealed the secrets of the hell to no man.
And the way that they defend their young as well, which is to feign injury to lure something away from the nest. It's just, they're such fierce things. It's beautiful.
Another song which is haunting and extremely memorable and all the more surprising because it comes from such a large animal is the song of the seals. You know, it's just so grey seals are the stuff of myth and folklore, particularly here in Scotland with the Selkie tradition.
When I was about 14, I heard a story written by Kevin Corsley Holland called People of the Sea, and that was when I met my first Selkie, I suppose. And I've been looking for one ever since. Not to steal its skin, because the part I could never understand is how you could take the skin of a Selkie so that you could keep them as a husband or wife. And this one thing that they need, that they love, you won't give them back. You just... You know, in Selkie stories, usually the man falls in love with a woman or the woman falls in love with a man. They keep the skins hidden and won't return it. And I just remember thinking when I was 14, that's not love. I guess that's what these stories are for, because they teach us so much about ourselves, really.
Have you got them round you?
Yeah, we have. It's one of the great joys of having moved here. I knew there were seals around, but I didn't know that within a mile of my house there's a seal breeding beach where they come every year and pup. And you could just walk up and just go and watch them. You see them grow. You see them being taught to swim. You see that connection between the mother and the child. I thought they were very sensible because it's only 6 weeks before they're fully fledged and the mum just wanders off. And I remember thinking when my kids were about 12, oh, coming back as a seal, definitely. Yeah.
I have to tell Mark about the conversation that we had the other day, Jackie, where Jackie was giving me some advice about child rearing, which is basically ignore them and they'll become they'll become self-reliant. So I've been trying to practice that ever since.
I would have to say, in your case, Needham, that advice is probably entirely redundant. You've been following that path for some years now.
Well, okay, maybe you just affirm. That was a bit of affirmation that I needed.
Yeah. It's called benign neglect, and what you teach them is self-reliance.
Yeah.
So that's my theory.
It's about like being raised by wolves, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It seems to have worked with mine because they've gone and they seem to be all right. Yeah.
Your final choice is a bird that's known for its powerful song, the nightingale, not something we get in Scotland, but it's a bird that's captured the imagination of artists, poets and songwriters for centuries. Why have you chosen the nightingale?
The nightingale, I couldn't understand it. You know, all birds sing beautifully, absolutely beautifully. And then I went to Suffolk. My visit to Suffolk coincided with nightingales being there. And I went to a place called Potton Hall and I just sat at dusk and waited. And oh my word, the strength of that song and the beauty of that song in the dusk was just astonishing. I have to say I love larks as well, and there are a lot of larks around here in the spring, but it's that song going on into the darkness, I guess, that is the difference. How such sound, which carries so far, comes from something so small is just astonishing.
And I suppose, maybe from your point of view, the simple act of taking the time to observe that.
And listen, to listen. I need to listen more and speak less. It's probably not a good thing for a podcast.
We'll just sit here in silence
but
for a while.
Do you know that feeling? Sometimes you just... Even, I mean, you can't listen to silence because
it doesn't exist.
Well, there are places, I think, where it is. But for me, silence is the absence of human and every other sound is welcome. I guess during the first lockdown, we kind of heard what the world might have sounded like to our grandparents and great-grandparents. Except when they were alive, there were more birds and the bird song was a lot louder. It seems really harsh that The Silent Spring was written in, was it the 60s? And yet here we are with all the same problems and it seems like we have fewer birds each year and now we have a government that's approving pesticides that kill bees in the face of all... understanding that this is not a sensible way to be.
I suppose what you're doing through your work is drawing people's attention to all of this, to all these birds, to all these creatures.
Yeah, I try to. I mean, one of the things that happened very early on with the Lost Words was during one of our events, the chairperson said, you know, well, this is all very well, but what we really need is for people to be out there on the streets being angry and protesting. the only response I could have to that was that protest doesn't have to be loud. It doesn't have to be angry. And I guess all the work that I do now is my response, my protest, but I try and make it as beautiful as I can because I think that makes it more accessible to people.
We're awfully glad that you've managed to take the time to speak with us today. We're very much obliged to you. We were really looking forward to speaking to you, and it's just been great. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. And I'd like to say thank you as well to you because I was listening to your podcast with Corinne, which was actually recorded on my birthday. It was like having this strange birthday present because I was listening to it, and then all of a sudden she started talking about the Lost Words, and I thought, oh, it's getting surreal now.
You can find all the information about Jackie's work at her website, JackieMorris, that's all one word, .co.uk, and her latest book with Robert McFarlane, The Lost Spells, is out now. Please get in touch with us and tell us where you listen to this podcast. You can email outofdoors, all one word, at bbc.co.uk. From myself, Mark Stephen, Helen Needham, and of course, Jackie Morris, thanks for listening.